Our Hebrew Scriptures lesson for today comes from the prophet Isaiah in the 5th chapter. Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning God's vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, inhabitants of Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I expected it to yield grapes, why did it yield sour grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and it shall be overgrown with briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel and the people of Judah and his pleasant planting. God expected justice, but saw bloodshed, righteousness, but heard a cry. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. And now may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. I remember a day in Austin when I was riding my bike and taking the Austin Metro Rail in to work that day. I had to be a bit earlier than usual because I was meeting my lectionary study group that morning. So in my rush, I grabbed my bike and my helmet and went out the door, and I didn't take any time to eat breakfast. I got to the train, and it was so full and overstuffed that I wasn't able to fit on with my bike, so I had to wait and take the next train. It took 20 or 30 minutes for the next one to come along. I was getting pretty hungry, and I was feeling angry, something that I think we've all begun to know as quite hangry. And I can tell you, I'm not much fun to be around when I'm hangry. I pressed on, and I made it to Father Larry's home, who was our gracious host that week. And I was very grateful when I got there to see that he had pulled out all the stops for the week and gone and gotten fresh fruit, coffee, juice, and my personal favorite, warm bagels, sitting on the table with a variety of different kinds of flavored cream cheese. Music to my ear, salvation before my eyes, actually. So he said hello, and I tried my best to be somewhat polite as I flew past him and to the table, put some grapes on my plate, not so much because I'm concerned about being healthy, but I am concerned about appearing to be healthy. And then I went for the bagel, just a plain one, no need to be showy. And I think there's probably a socially acceptable amount of cream cheese that you can put on a bagel. I didn't bother with that morning. I piled it up, didn't even bother sitting down. I chose the strawberry, I piled it high, and I dug right in. It's just pink cream cheese across my mouth. It was so amazing, except that it was really disgusting. Something was really wrong. I didn't know what was wrong, but it was musty and strange tasting. And so I said, as others were coming in and gathering their bagels, don't eat the strawberry, it's gone sour. There's something wrong with it. And Father Larry said, I didn't put any strawberry out, only the blueberry and the plain and that salmon spread over there. I like salmon, but when you're expecting strawberry, it's quite a powerful flavor. I was disgusted. And that's how it is, isn't it? In life, when you're expecting one thing, but you get another, it can be disgusting. You may have even noticed just a moment ago in the hymn that we sang, we have an expectation at First Baptist, don't we? We're blessed with remarkable musicians, and we have beautiful music each week. And so this week I asked Julian, as we sang our most recent hymn, if he would play as beautifully as he always does. And then on the second and third verses, just make it sound a bit strange. It's truly the first time I've ever asked a musician to play poorly in church. But I don't know if you noticed, as I did, that it didn't feel quite the same. Julian's too talented for us to be fully disgusted. But when you're expecting one thing and you get something else, it can disgust you. The poetic prophet Isaiah told his people, as we read just a moment ago, that even God is subject to being disgusted. But in his poem, it was a vineyard for which God had high expectations and which left God disgusted. The poet's beloved, which is God, had found a wonderful hillside, an excellent place for growing grapes because the water runs off quickly, which forces the roots to grow deeply and creates more surface area for taking in all of the nutrients that go into rich and complex flavored grapes. And there, in that ideal place, the beloved had the rocks painstakingly and slowly removed from the field, and the soil broken and made ready for its first ever planting. And only the finest vines were chosen, and to protect them from all that could harm them, a tower was built for a watchman. The expectation for this vineyard was so great that the beloved had a wine vat built on site. The grapes would be sown here and grown here and would be used to produce the choicest wine here. The vineyard had everything it needed to be something truly special, which is why the beloved was so utterly disgusted when the fruit of the vineyard turned out to be soured. Can you imagine the feeling of those in Israel who were among those who heard this poem for the first time? Can you imagine how they resonated with the frustration and the disgust of the sour grapes? They even understood the desire of the beloved to tear down the watchtower, to tear out the vines and let no rain fall on the land, and let the vineyard be overgrown until no trace of it remained. Because that's how people respond to things that disgust them. But imagine how that resonance would fade when they heard, "The vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, the people of Judah." They would be disgusted, but disgusted because they would have to hear in the poem their own story. It is the nation of Israel who had been given every opportunity. They are the ones who have come out of captivity in Egypt and have broken ground in a fertile land. They are the ones who have been watched over by God, who have been rescued from oppression. They are the ones who have been planted in the soil of a promised land. No, they are the promised land. They are the ones from whom God expected to see a kingdom of justice and mercy and equality arise. They hear of themselves in the poem and they hear of God's disgust, and suddenly the poem itself turns sour in the mouths of its hearers. God is disgusted with them. But what went wrong? How had they become a fruitless vineyard? How had they gone from being the oppressed to being the liberated to now being the oppressor? It is near the universal conviction of the biblical prophets that the nation of Israel had grown comfortable in its position, and they had hewn out a place for them between the great nations of the world. And some of its people had grown very comfortable on the backs of the lowest among them and on the backs of those who had come from elsewhere. Having been liberated, they weren't bearing the fruit of liberation, but continuing cycles of oppression and captivity. Their grapes were soured despite having been given every possible necessity to bear good fruit. It is in their story, in this poem, that we learn that it is entirely possible to be able to show off the trappings of a beautiful, functional, well-equipped, scenic vineyard, but have no fruit to show for it. But what is left? What other factor could cause the grapes to sour beyond the best location, the best tools, top security? Everything has been provided. The only thing left that could sour the grapes at that point is if the soil itself were incomplete. It is an appropriate time for us to engage a cautionary tale as we're getting underway in our year of celebration of our bicentennial. You're going to hear a lot this year about what God has given us and about the road we've journeyed, and about how we came to be planted where we are. You'll hear a lot, too, about the fruit we hope to continue to bear in the months and years ahead. Justice, peace, reconciliation, compassion, equality. But these things are the end. They are the fruit. So what, then, are the component parts of them? What are the nutrients which must be folded into the soil, into our community? I've been thinking a lot about this lately. I've become more aware and more frustrated with many of the ills in our world and our seeming inability as a society to do much, if anything, about them. I'm a fairly pragmatic person. I tend to think that the best solution to a problem is to go right at it with concrete action plans. The problem I keep bumping into in my mind for now is that concrete action plans that solve big problems are called public policy. Public policy comes in our society from consensus. And fostering consensus for the moment is a very near impossible task. In fact, in some places, it's not even possible to discuss what might be done without stepping on one another's toes. This condition itself, then, becomes not only a barrier to solving problems, but one of our biggest problems in itself. You see, I think our soil is depleted. We're bearing mostly opinions and not much action. Our grapes in this land have soured. We keep saying that we need more justice, more peace, more equality, but our cries have amounted to standing next to the vines and yelling at them for not producing. If justice is what we want from the vines, we're going to have to make sure that the soil is enriched with the nutrients that come together to form justice, peace, and equality. And I think those nutrients in the social world are called attitudes. We still have room, I think, to talk about what is within us. We have room to talk about our attitudes. In fact, I think the church is uniquely suited to that kind of conversation. The world around us might actually expect us to be able to talk about internal struggles these days. We might actually have a natural place in helping to amend the soil of our society, so long as we tend to our own soil first. So what are the attitudes? What are the nutrients that we need to be folding into the soil of our life together? I don't really know that I'm the authority on that, but I have some ideas, and maybe you'll have others. One attitude that seems missing is difficult kindness. We actually still have a lot of kindness in our world, but this is a particular kind of kindness. You've seen coverage, I'm sure, of people showing kindness to one another in the aftermath of storms or after acts of violence. I'm grateful for people giving one another a hand. And this seems to be an attitude that we still have in abundance. But we do well to notice that this is simple kindness. And we've always been good at being there for one another when there's some common enemy. It's when the inevitable competition of our lives and our ideas and our economies gets going again that we lose our kindness. We need to mix in the type of kindness that happens when the cameras aren't rolling, the kind of inner concern for others that delights truly in the benefit of others and not in recognition for the benefit of others. We need more of an attitude that can sacrifice in secret, that can give of its own resources and even of its own security for the benefit of those who will never know that it happened. That's difficult kindness. And we also need vulnerable courage. We've become masterful in our world at this point at generating opinions and people who will carry those opinions. In so doing, we've put a lot of courage into the soil of our world. We've got a lot of people who have the courage to say the unpopular, but still needed things. But the hostility of our environment tends to make us, after saying those things, recoil and brace for a sort of return volley. It may be that alongside the prophets of our world, we also need conversationalists. People who can say the hard truth, but then absorb rather than reflect the anger that will often come back. It's that kind of vulnerability coupled with courage that might allow us to start talking again. Of course, there's no shortage of causes to be discussed, no shortage of social ills in our world today. If truth-telling is our only mode of existence, then we'll be having nothing but hard conversations all the time. Once in a while, we need to take a break and just delight in one another's presence. It might even be true that this should be our default mode, while allowing the hard conversations to be frequent exceptions to the rule. But to know when to press and on what and for how long, which hard conversations to have, these are not simple passive decisions in our day, but critical skills in being a socially conscious Christian. And we'll need wisdom for that. We need more wisdom in the soil. But we're also short on a strange little nutrient that I heard about just last week. It's a nutrient called bristling. Colgate Rochester Divinity School had a wonderful series of lectures, just as they do every fall. Dr. Lisa Thompson, a preaching professor at Union Seminary in New York City, rightly identified that many of today's social ills come about when a particular aspect of society that has benefited one group of people has created an inequity for another group or groups of people. Some of these inequities have been inadvertent, but some, we have to confess, have not. Racism, for instance, is not an inequity, but a very large set of inequities that has very intentional roots in our American history, and now is carried out sometimes inadvertently. It still has many and wide-ranging intentional sources, mind you, but it has also become so ingrained in the dailiness of our lives that many of us participate in devastating racism while being none the wiser. Dr. Thompson pointed out that bringing this to the fore of our conversation is a necessity in our days. But that's going to sting for those of us who've not been aware and have benefited from the status quo. People are going to have to be willing to accept that shock and irritation, she told us. They're going to have to learn to bristle a little. Bristling, as she used the word, means to recognize and acknowledge the hard emotions that do come with realizing that you've been a part of a beneficiary in a system that needs to change. But to take those emotions and sit with them without the need to express them to those for whom the system has not worked. In our world, men need to learn the attitude of bristling. And white people need to learn the attitude of bristling. And people who've been given or have earned a decent piece of the economic pie need to learn to bristle. And my saying so very well may frustrate you a little. So here's your opportunity to practice bristling. Difficult kindness, vulnerable courage, wisdom, and bristling. These are just a handful of attitudes that I think we need turned into the soil of our lives together if we're going to see good fruit. But I bet that you have ideas about what attitudes need cultivating too. The good news is, honing our attitudes, amending the soil, is the only thing we have left to be done, because God has already given us the vineyard. Amen.